A look at the tragedy in Sunrise that took the lives of two FBI agents. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It's one of the worst days in FBI history. Two agents are dead when they tried to serve a warrant. What went wrong? The agents were investigating child crimes. We'll learn how prevalent this criminal activity is in South Florida. Also, do you understand what's happening on Wall Street right now as thousands of amateur traders are trying to take on institutional investors? We'll try and make sense of what happened and the implications for the future of trading stocks. And finally, Florida is sometimes jokingly described as God's waiting room. The host of WNYC's podcast, Death, Sex, and Money, joins us ahead of a special program tonight exploring what it means to age during COVID. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Two FBI agents were killed and three more were injured in Sunrise, Florida yesterday while serving a warrant on an alleged child abuser's home. An FBI agent hasn't been killed on duty since 2008. Daniel Alfin and Laura Schwarzenberger have dedicated their careers to fighting child pornography. A lot of the details of the shooting are unclear. Now, the identity of the alleged child abuser who killed themselves during the raid has not been released. The Miami Herald's David Ovalle has been following the story and joins us now. David, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
What are the details that the FBI have released so far? What are they telling us?
Well, the basic story is that a group of five agents went to serve a search warrant on a person who was suspected of having child pornography, downloading child pornography at a home in suburban Sunrise yesterday morning. These things can be pretty routine. They happen, you know, a couple times a month, a couple times a week, depending and they happen without a hitch usually. But in this case, what we've reported so far is that the agents were pretty much ambushed as they were walking up to the apartment door. Basically, the suspected gunman or the gunman fired through the door, blowing out the front door and basically cutting down the agents. Five were wounded, two of them fatally, two of them were hospitalized, and the fifth one didn't suffer an injury that required hospitalization.
And the FBI identified the two officers, the two agents killed. They were Special Agents Daniel Alfin and Laura Schwarzenberger. What do we know about their backgrounds and careers with the department?
Well, they were both veteran investigators who had mostly in Miami been assigned to doing internet crimes against children, right? So these are the child porn investigations. These are the people who were suspected of manufacturing or trading in illicit images of children. And they were very well thought of. They were very well known in that area. Alfin particularly had been involved in one of the larger child porn rings from the last few years, an operation called Playpen is what it was called. And it was, hundreds and hundreds of people that were suspected of being part of this ring. And Laura as well had you know, really been one of these people, pretty outspoken in terms of warning people and particularly children about sextortion and being victims of crimes. And so she was a very welcoming voice in terms of, advocating for children to stay safe, right? So, she visited children's schools, spoke out on the media, stuff like that. So they were both really well known in that world of law enforcement.
You know, something you said a moment ago that, that sometimes these kind of things are routine, depending on they happen every week or so, but, and yet there's a process, and I'm wondering what the FBI has said about, or what law enforcement said about how you're supposed to execute a warrant. And I wonder if the FBI has said anything about what level of threat did they think, these agents were going to be facing.
They have not come out and specified exactly what went into their thinking and their assessment of this man as a threat. Now, it is not uncommon for a FBI SWAT team or a SWAT team from another police department to assist and take the lead on going into these types of these types of raids, but that's an assessment that they have to make. So clearly they did not think that this person was enough of a threat that they needed to bring in sort of the tactical units, right? By chance, there happened to be a tactical unit doing a similar raid in the area, completely unrelated, the Broward SWAT team, and they actually were on scene pretty quickly because they were sort of in the geographic area and were able to come in and help and actually even help extricate one of the agents who was wounded. So, yeah, I mean, that's one of the sort of the unknowns that everyone's trying to figure out, and the FBI has so far not addressed in specific, although they, you know, they did say these things are routine and, you know, we're always, and the mass majority of them go off without a hitch.
And as has been reported, it's believed that the shooter saw the agents possibly through the doorbell camera. That's a typical technology these days now that we have, and was able then to allegedly ambush the agents because of that. I wanted to know what else we've heard from the FBI about, you know, in that situation. I believe they also called afterwards, they called Broward Sheriff. The SWAT team came in, right?
The SWAT team came in, yes. And they ended up surrounding the apartment. There was, you know, a bit of a standoff, barricaded suspect kind of thing. And then he was ultimately found dead. Now, our law enforcement sources have told us it's believed that he killed himself.
No, it's a he. We don't have a name yet.
I mean, we're assuming it's a he. I mean, we okay. have not gotten the name, but you know, it's very rare that a woman would be involved in these types of shootings. We haven't seen too much of that. But yes, as of right now, we do not have a name, and they have not released a name.
Again, talking with the Miami Herald's David Ovalle yesterday, two FBI agents were killed while serving a warrant on an alleged child abuser's home. You can find more of his reporting on this story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. David, this is a division, as you had mentioned, of the FBI that investigates child crimes. How big is that unit here in South Florida?
It's pretty sizable. I mean, you can go in on any given week in federal court and sometimes in state court, and you'll see people who are getting routinely arrested. And most of these cases are relatively anonymous, right? You're not, you know, it's someone who's tracked down to an IP address to an internet service for a home, and then they go in and they, you know, talk to the person who's in, usually relatively anonymous people who don't rise to the level of much media coverage. But it's pretty, you know, it's a pretty sizable contingent here. I mean, it's a huge problem, not just here, but all across the United States and frankly the world, the sort of trading in these illicit images, and of course the production of these illicit images.
You said around the world, but is that a crime that's more prominent here in South Florida? Why would they have such a big, you know, division for that here?
I mean, I think they have it everywhere. I mean, I think if you go to any part of the country, they have sizable units that work on these things. And generally, they're task force that are composed of not just FBI agents, but also local detectives from agencies that are assigned to work with the Fed. So they often are doing these things and roundups and checking out these tips. It's a whole world that goes unseen that these people delve into to try to capture these criminals.
And if you're investigating things like this, internet crimes, why is it important to be based in that area? Why can't, for example, you know, you're investigating internet crimes, you could be almost anywhere in the country doing that?
Well, the way it works is often these tips are routed through the internet providers, and they go to the National Center for Exploited Children and Missing Children. So what happens is they kind of get farmed out through there. So let's just say like AT&T says, hey, we've detected an image that is known to be a child porn image. And so it'll, you know, the IP address comes back to a place in Sunrise, Florida, right? So then in Sunrise, Florida, then they'll alert the agents and the task force or for whoever is for that region. And then that's how the cases kind of get farmed out to where the geography of the suspect is.
Do we know, have they said any, the FBI said anything about, was this part of some bigger child porn ring, or is this just one person they were investigating?
Best we can tell right now, they have not said, but from our talking to law enforcement sources, it is just, an individual. Now, it could be part of a bigger ring, of course, that remains to be seen, because all these things are connected, because most of these guys are trading images through what's called peer-to-peer networks, right? So think of programs. I mean, if you want to, like the old LimeWire and those kinds of programs, of course, there's many new incarnations of that, but they trade through these programs that, allow people to share. So, it's usually connected to a bigger ring.
What's next in the investigation? I mean, they haven't released the name of the accused, but usually how long does that take? And what else are they looking into right now?
Well, the forensics, they flew down agents from Quantico, Virginia to do all the forensics. I mean, it's a massive amount of work to document everything. So they have people still there right now. FBI Director Christopher Wray is actually coming to South Florida to meet with the family members and to meet with the agents and other people involved in the investigation. So that's going on today. And then ultimately, the FBI will just have to, I'm sure we'll look at sort of the procedures and what went into the whole thing to see if there's anything they can do to better improve safety of agents in the future. And then we'll have to find out who the person is. I mean, they have not released the name of the person, or who even, an age or anything like that, but clearly it's, suburban Sunrise. So it wasn't, someone that, we would jump out at you right away. There might be a potential threat.
Exactly. The Miami Herald's David Ovalle. You can follow more of his reporting on this story on our Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. David, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And our thoughts go out to the families of those two FBI agents who lost their lives in duty yesterday. Well, still to come, stonks, tendies, and wildness on Wall Street. Senior producer Chris Remington explores the saga between amateur traders and hedge funds.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Chris Remington, sitting in for Luis Hernandez.
After calculating the estimates from various orange-producing states, we have concluded the following. The cold winter has apparently not affected the orange harvest.
Winter. Valentine.
Hey, how'd you make out today?
How could you do this to us after everything we've done for you?
Oh, see, I made Lewis a bet here. The Lewis bet me that we couldn't both get rich and put y'all in the poorhouse at the same time. He didn't think we could do it. I won.
I lost. $1.
That was Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy from the classic 1983 film Trading Places. The investment markets look very different from nearly 40 years ago. One big change, the noise, has moved from trading floors to computer screens. And there's a big fight happening there now between institutional brokers, large hedge funds, and amateur traders. A subgroup on the platform Reddit, an online forum, has been pushing thousands of everyday traders to buy stock in companies like video game retailer GameStop and movie theater operator AMC Entertainment. The push is coinciding with large hedge funds shorting these stocks, betting that the stocks aren't worth their current market value. Billions of dollars are at stake. And now Congress is exploring whether more regulation is needed. We're joined now by Dr. Rainford Knight, finance professor at Florida Atlantic University. Dr. Knight, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Pleasure to be here.
And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the battle in the market? Do you think more regulation is needed? Call in 1-800-743-9576. Again, 1-800-743-9576. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Rainford, I'm going to go back in time a little bit, back to fall of 2008. I was a senior in high school taking an introduction to economics class. And my teacher, a former Wall Street investor himself, he threw the textbook out in October. Lehman Brothers had just crashed. The Great Recession was upon us. And he said, we're going to learn about this crash while it's happening. I'm curious for you as a professor, how are you teaching about this moment and what's happening in the stock market right now?
Yeah, that's a good question, Chris. In the classroom, we typically I typically teach that, you know, when you look at markets, it's dominated by the big institutions on the trading side. And so the retail investor is at a significant disadvantage. I think this event with GameStop has really shed light on the power of retail, the power the retail investor can have when they get together and publicly display, and this is where the SEC is having a problem, speak to the fact that they're going to move in on a particular stock.
And when you say retail investor, you're just talking about you and me, any average Joe that wants to buy.
That's exactly right. The average Joe who trades on any app, Robinhood is a popular one amongst others, that really want to get a piece of the action, but is at a significant disadvantage in most cases because of the big institutions and the way they trade.
So I'm curious, do you have students in your class who might be on Reddit, who are invested in these stocks, and they're saying, look, I'm holding out, I believe in this. Like, how do you talk to those students about this?
Well, firstly, I say, well, is it money you can lose? And that's a big question, right? Because, you know, yes, a lot of these students now are trading on, particularly on Robinhood or anywhere else you get zero commission trading. And many are going in because it's exciting and they think the opportunity is there for them to make a lot of money. And I warn against that. I said, listen, you know, there are a lot of risks and you are at a disadvantage because the market is an institutionally driven market. So you just can't trade in hopes that you're going to win all the time. Chances are you're going to lose most of the time.
And we should note, last week, a lot of those folks made a lot of money. And this week, a lot of those folks are losing a lot of money. So the stock market waxes and wanes, as we all know. Again, speaking with Rainford Knight, finance professor at Florida Atlantic University, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about this battle in the market? Do you think more regulation is needed? 1-800-743-9576 or find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. So Rainford, you mentioned Robinhood again. This is a free online trading platform. Many amateur traders are using this. But let's go back a couple of weeks and see where this all started. Explain what hedge funds like Melvin Capital were doing when they were purchasing shorts of GameStop. What was the strategy?
The strategy with GameStop, for those that are not familiar, is a mall retailer of video games. And for years, sales of this business, sales were in decline. The stock price was declining until a group of traders on the Reddit platform started to buy the stock and shares started to rise. It caught the attention of the hedge funds that were short sellers, that is, borrowing shares to sell them, hoping to buy them back at a significantly lower price later. And so Melvin Capital is one of those firms, with the idea being the investment thesis, there's no way this company is worth much simply because e-commerce has changed the landscape of retail dramatically. And so they saw that the 17, the price increase as not being valid in terms of reflecting the value of the business.
And so we might have some listeners saying, wait, I don't get this. You can sell a stock before you own it. Why don't we explain what shorting is and why it's important in sort of keeping a check and balance in the market?
Absolutely. The stock market is the only business on the planet where you can sell something you don't own, which is short selling. And so short selling involves borrowing shares that you don't own, selling those shares at, let's say, $10, and hoping that, with the belief that the company stock that you're shorting, that it's worth $2 a share. It's significantly overvalued at $10, hoping to buy the shares back at a later point, $1, $2, or maybe return them for a value of zero. And that's essentially what shorting is. It's kind of like borrowing your neighbor's car and selling it, and they're on vacation and you know they're going to come back in 2 weeks. They're going to return the car because you can buy it cheaper at a dealer somewhere.
And that's a good example because cars are always losing value. So
exactly. That's exactly right.
Definitely a good time to short. Again, talking with Rainford Knight, finance professor at Florida Atlantic University. We're hearing from callers now looking again about whether more regulation is needed in the stock market. Let's go to Ozzy in Miramar. Ozzy, welcome to the program.
Well, you know, here you for more regulations. I don't think there should be any more. Just be left the way it is. Those people were shorting the stock and other people heard about it. Why more regulation? Just leave it the way it is. They were underestimating what the company's worth or not agreeing with what the company is worth. It is what it is. Just leave it, let it be, and I'll take your answer off the air, okay?
Okay, thanks, Ozzy. You were cutting in and out a little bit there, but the main message is keep it the way it is. More regulation isn't needed. Let's go to another caller, David in Palm Beach. He's a retired trader. David, welcome to the program.
Welcome.
David, what is your question or comment?
My comment is, first of all, in explaining short sales, I tried to explain this to my girlfriend, and the best way I can explain it is a shoe store is having a sale, and $50 shoes are on sale for $25. You go to the store, you say, I'd like to buy a pair of shoes. The owner of the store says, we sold them all out, but I'll give you a rain check so you can buy the shoes at $25. So the store owner now is short a pair of shoes. He sold a pair of shoes. He doesn't own them. Now he has to buy them in the future, and let's say all of a sudden the pair of shoes goes up to $50. Well, he's going to lose $25 because he has to go out and buy the shoes from the manufacturer, and he has to pay back or sell the shoes for $25. That's essentially what a short sale is.
Right, and to your point, David, a lot of these hedge funds lost a lot of money as GameStop stock really exploded last week because they have to buy those shares back.
Well, they had to because of margin calls. They're required. Right. They must buy them back. And it got very painful for the people that were short. As far as regulation goes, as I said earlier, what happens to markets is they will self-regulate in this instance. By that, I mean the people that most of the people that invested in this GameStop will lose quite a bit of money or whatever money they invested. That will self-regulate those markets. And it will have an effect on people that short now because they saw what just happened.
David, a lot of interesting points there. I want to thank you for the call. A lot we want to cover today. Again, we want to hear from you. 1-800-743-9576. With all the craziness going on in the stock market, should there be more regulation? 800-743-9576. Okay, Rainford, we covered a lot there. We heard from two callers that suggested, no, we don't think more regulation is necessary. But we saw what happened with Robinhood, where they decided to not allow users to buy stock at one point last week, and folks were complaining about it. So my question for you is, should there be more regulation?
My view, and by the way, before I address that question, I just want to make sure everybody understands that the GameStop trade was not about making money. The retail traders got together because they really wanted to sock it to the hedge funds that they felt for years were putting them at a significant disadvantage. This was not about making money. This was about how can we get even, right? And so that was the basis for that trade. That many of them expected to lose. And there's even a segment on, I think it's Reddit, called Loss Porn, where you display your losses, your red bars on the screen, and people applaud that. So it's not, this is a whole different kind of psychology we're talking about here.
Yeah, there's a whole interesting angle that we'll get into in terms of what's motivating people. But let's talk first about the regulation issue and whether we think there needs to be more regulation in these markets. As you said, it's really easy for any average Joe to buy stocks now.
Right. And on the regulation, though, the SEC has never really encountered anything like this before, because this is mass buying in public, and the investors, they know what the risks are. So how do you regulate something that's it's public that, yes, we're going to take these risks and we could lose our shirt doing it, and we're fine doing so. So I think this is new territory for the SEC. They are looking into the transactions to see what occurred, if there are any major hedge funds on the trading side, which would create a problem. But as of now, I think it's just they are at the investigation stage in terms of trying to assess what really happened. More now regulation? No, I'm definitely opposed to that.
Interesting. You had mentioned earlier about this subgroup on Reddit that's on losses. I think it'd be useful for the audience to give a little context. This all started from this group called Wall Street Bets on Reddit. Can you tell us a little bit about this group, who these folks are, and how they were able to influence such massive swings in the market?
From what I know, and I don't know a lot, the Wall Street Bets group is a Reddit. It's a retail trading group where you can put up trade ideas. And so the idea of this movement on not just game stock, by the way, AMC, BlackBerry, yep, as well as Silver, these were all securities that were targeted. It's a mindset issue that we're small, we've been taken advantage of for all these years. Let's get together and be impactful. Right. This is not about making money. Yes, some people did make money, but at the end of the day, the philosophy is very leading edge in terms of losses are fine, but we want to send a message.
Again, speaking with Rainford Knight, finance professor at Florida Atlantic University, discussing the stock market and this fight going on between thousands of amateur traders and hedge funds over stocks like GameStop and AMC. What questions do you have about the battle in the market? Do you believe more regulation is needed? Again, 1-800-743-9576. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We've got another caller, Michael in Delray Beach. He's got an interesting point here, Michael. You think there should be collateral because you have to have collateral to use a brokerage house, right?
It's more the professor got it partially correct. You have to own something if you're going to have that ability to short. No brokerage is going to sign you up unless you have collateral with them in case the trade goes against you. Also, I feel there should be regulation if the retail or professional investor doesn't know what they're getting themselves into. And that occurs a lot, even on the professional side. So that if an individual just blindly looks at the advertisements or the marketing of whoever is putting out an investment, there should be some regulation to make sure this isn't a fraud.
Michael, that's a really interesting point. And I know some of the complaints lodged against Robinhood is about their advertising, their predatory messaging to get anybody to get onto the platform. Thank you again for joining us, Michael. And Rainford, just can you explain for our listeners what a brokerage house is for folks who might not know?
A brokerage firm, many of these trades have to clear through some pipeline to the market. So a clearinghouse, in the case of Robinhood, one of the reasons why they had to get a capital injection is that you have to put up capital to clear the trades. Well, the volume was so tremendous that the capital that was there was not sufficient. So they had to raise $2 or $3 billion. And thus, they had to limit the trading based on the fact that they didn't have the capital available to cover the trades.
Yeah, they didn't have enough money to do it. It's really interesting.
Exactly.
So I'm curious, you've been working in this financial world for many years. You've been teaching in it. Have you ever seen such a large group of internet followers have a direct impact on real market outcomes? I'm thinking of the dot-com bubble. Like, have there been any other instances where this has happened in any capacity?
Honestly, good question. Not that I can think of. This is the power of the internet, the power of the retail trader in mass, and this is I've seen the first of its kind.
Yeah, it is truly a fascinating phenomenon. And we were talking a little bit about the philosophy earlier. I read an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal that compared this phenomenon to what we're seeing with QAnon, for instance, or the investors of Bitcoin, where you have a lot of folks going online, pushing a mob mentality and doing things that might be irrational. For instance, users posting on GameStop saying it's at $400 a share, keep buying and hold, even when indications say it's going to swing down. So I guess my question for you is there any logic in what these traders are doing right now? Is there any sort of sound principles in investing, or is this purely irrational mob mentality?
It's not just irrational mob mentality. It's not even irrational exuberance. It's just madness. This is not about necessarily buying something of value and looking for the upside. This is, let's create losses for the institutions, and we're going to show them that we want to get even, and we're going to hold if necessary so that we can do that, right? We can have an impact, a negative impact. So it's more of a mob mentality, and rationality is out the window here.
And I mean, what's fascinating for me, having dug through some of these Reddit boards, is you'll have folks that'll come on there and they'll give long explanations as to why they're holding at certain times and what prices you should be looking for. But you're saying ultimately that's not really founded in sound logic.
No, and remember, a stock is tied to a business, a real business, and the GameStop, that business is not no longer a business that one can consider a growth business, right? So so the value of the underlying, the business, is the value is not there, or that business is losing value. So how can you justify that share price? It doesn't make sense.
The fundamentals aren't there. Absolutely. Again, speaking with Rainford Knight, finance professor at Florida Atlantic University. We're hearing from our callers. Again, 1-800-743-9576. We got Phil in Pembroke Pines. Phil, thanks for being with us.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I have two comments, then a question. For the regulation part, I would say that there shouldn't be any more or less regulations that makes it fair for everybody. Because I think that big companies, they're not really against regulations. As I see it, as long as they don't affect them and the regulations, that then if you put too many regulations, the big companies can survive and the small retailers cannot survive in that regulation. So my question is to the professor, the institutional investor versus the retail investor. Like, what is, could you kind of either explain that more, or can the market shift to a different, to be more retail investor focused, or what are some of the other options for people who are hoping to invest in companies other than the stock market?
Well, to answer your question about, if you look at the market now, it's about a trading volume, about 20% of that is retail. The other 80% or so is institutional volume. So that shift would require a significant level of participation from retail, and I don't see that happening, particularly as markets become driven, more technology driven, as we move forward here in time. So I don't see the retail investor having a significant impact on markets, except for these types of scenarios where you have this mass participation in securities that are not they're illiquid, but the liquidity levels are not there, like an Amazon or a Tesla or something like that. So I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. And most of the retail investors that participate in these markets, they use a lot of leverage, right? 43%, looking at a survey of investors, retail investors use leverage, and it's usually along the lines of options, margins, or margin transactions, or option-based transactions. So they're not really, in terms of capital, because the retail investor capital base is, on average, is typically relatively small. They have to lever up to participate.
Gotcha. I hope that answers your question, Phil. Thank you for joining us. And we've got one other caller, an interesting perspective, Richard in Miami. He doesn't think this is mob mentality. He thinks it's trading strategy. Richard, why don't you explain?
Yeah, self-confess, I've been following Wall Street bets for a long time, and the issue at hand was Wall Street bets identified that these hedge funds shorted the stock to a tune of 158% of the shares out there. We as traders said, well, supply and demand, someone's going to have to buy shares to cover those bets. So we piled in, and it became a feedback loop. It drove the cost up, probably higher than any of us expected. But I think the hedge funds got punished for doing something that was, on their part, quite silly.
Interesting. So what do you say to that, Rainford?
The step before that is, the reason the hedge funds piled in is because the retail investors had bid up the stock so that the price was out of line with the fundamentals. And then the Wall Street bet traders got in and decided, well, you know, they're going to start to participate and short the stock to over 100% of the outstanding shares. That's when the, well, let's punish them mindset, I think, entered the trade. Mm-hmm.
Thank you again, Richard in Miami, for joining us. Still getting plenty of callers. Unfortunately, we got to wrap up here soon. So Rainford, I want to ask you this. Do you think this is a seminal moment for the stock market and sort of looking at the inequities that are involved in trading? You said it yourself. Retail investors really don't stand a chance a lot against a lot of these big guys. Is this an opportunity for the stock market to be rethought, or is this simply a blip on the map and things will go back to normal in a couple of weeks?
I think from my perspective that the SEC is really really has to look at, well, what when we talk about the market, what's wrong with the infrastructure that will allow this sort of thing to occur? What are some imperfections that exist that may need to be addressed? I think it's definitely a moment from a regulatory perspective where they're going to have to take a really hard look at see in the clearing process, because a lot of this is driven by how clearing of trades work and the market makers that execute these transactions, right? And so if you buy 10 options and the delta is 25, I, as a market maker, have to offset that by buying 2,500 shares. So it's akin to every time you buy an out of the money call option, it's akin to buying shares, because the market maker has to hedge, or they will hedge, and they'll buy shares to offset the call. So and it works the other way too on the put side. So I think that infrastructure of the market will also have to be examined.
I've been speaking with Rainford Knight, professor of finance at Florida Atlantic University. Learn more about the story from NPR and continue the conversation on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Rainford, was a lot of fun. Thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me, Chris. My pleasure.
All right. Still to come, death, sex, and money. We're talking about a podcast about the things we think about, but don't often talk about.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Here are some things that we often think about, but we don't talk much about. Death, sex, and money. By the way, that's the title of a podcast by WNYC Studios in New York, and they're going to be talking about aging in a special live national call-in show called Getting Real About Getting Older. It's going to air tonight in place of Sundial, starts at 8 o'clock tonight here on WLRN. Anna Sale is the host of the podcast and will be co-hosting the special tonight along with Joanne Allen of Colorado Public Radio. And Anna joins us now. Anna, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I'm wondering, what was your motivation talking about the podcast? And I think about it and I'm like, how often do I talk about those topics? And I like to think that I talk about them openly. I feel comfortable, but no, actually I don't. But what was the motivation in starting a podcast talking about things that are kind of taboo, especially at the dinner table?
You know, for a long time, our show is almost 7 years old. And the original idea was, what if we peel back a little bit around these big, hard topics and have conversations, intimate conversations about them in a way, not kind of to be provocative or, you know, overly graphic, but just to give people a little bit more company, a sense of that they're not alone in figuring out some of this hard stuff. And so our show has long been about, like, where are the places where people might be feeling a little bit isolated or noticing some things in their life that they don't have words for. And that's what led us to aging this year. You know, this year, the pandemic has been a time when people who are older have felt a lot of changes in their lives and perhaps felt their physical vulnerability even more than those of us who are younger. So we wanted to kind of focus especially on people who are 60 plus. That's a really wide range. 60 plus and older is a really wide range of people. But we wanted to just hear stories about what people were noticing about feeling their age right now, if they're in that age group.
You know, with you, and because, I mean, you're not at 60 yet. You've got a ways to go. But I'm wondering what aging means to you and how many people over 60 are in your life that you talk to about aging.
Yeah. You know, I'm 40. I just turned 40 and I'm talking about aging a lot more, I'm noticing, since I've turned 40.
Trust me. I know what you mean.
Yeah. But something I have noticed in my own life, you know, I have my parents are in their 70s and 80s. I have some really dear friends and mentors who are in their upper 80s. And I noticed, you know, when I was maybe in my 30s, like I would, for my oldest friends, I was aware of their age and it kind of gave me this sense of dread that I didn't have as much time with them as I'd wanted. But I didn't say to them, what's it like being in your late 80s. You know, it was more about all about me and managing my own anxiety about their age. Yeah. And so through thinking about this, it's been really cool to shift the sets of questions we're asking and saying, like, what are you noticing? What are the things that are great about this time in your life? What are you enjoying letting go of? What's the stuff that's a little bit hard? And let them sort of lead the conversation instead of making my anxiety, you know, the thing that I pay most close attention to.
Yeah. You do shout outs to find the stories. And so, you know, for the topic of aging, you did a call out for stories about life, you know, at 60 and beyond. But what did you expect to get, and did it surprise you?
You know, we didn't really know. And what was really cool and surprising was it seemed like there were a lot of people who were just waiting to be asked, because the emails just flew in. We asked the question, you know, if you're over 60, what are you noticing about being your age right now? And how does that feel different from a year ago? And we heard stories about, you know, how people had sort of absorbed the isolation of COVID. We heard stories about people reflecting on their marriages and divorces and choices they'd made earlier in their lives. And it was really cool. To structure conversations around not just like what is special about this time of life when you're 60 plus, but also what's really different among different individuals. It's not just one thing.
Yeah. So many interesting stories that you have on the podcast. You heard from one Beverly Glenn Copeland, a Black mm-hmm. trans elder, and has a music career that took off actually, you know, really much later in life. But of course, the pandemic has taken a toll, gotten in the way. Tell me a little bit about Beverly.
Oh, what a wonderful story. I first heard about Glenn Copeland's music because there was a GoFundMe campaign early in the pandemic where he was expecting to have this international tour because his music had just been sort of rediscovered in the last couple of years. And then the tour got canceled, and all of that, all those earnings that he was expecting with his wife did not materialize. And so talking to him about both, you know, what it was like to move through the world, you know, and kind of trying to the process for him of finding words for how he wanted to describe his sexuality and his gender identity and how that changed over time. And what was really cool was hearing him talk about his relationships with his backup band. His backing band are all people in their mid-20s.
Yeah.
And, you know, what he is learning from them as they're out on the road. And also that he feels absolutely no self-consciousness whatsoever in making them carry his luggage.
And you know what? Rightfully so. You know what? Let's hear. I love that. That was a great part of it, too, is that, you know, the hanging out with people in their mid-20s and that age difference. So let's hear a little bit about that story.
I have a knee that, you know, really should be replaced. Sometimes it'll go out and I'll be in crutches. So like I have to travel with crutches in case it goes out and gets stuck in a bent position. Right. Uh-huh. So, and I've been going down the steps backwards for many years to lessen the stress on knees that are old. And of course, you know, I'm not going to be carrying anything going down the stairs backwards. So, you know, so they would lug all the stuff and, you know, they treated me as though I was an elder, like their grandparents. Hmm. And they were totally caretaking in that kind of way. And I loved it.
Oh, I love that. And there's some of the music. I'm wondering what else did you learn from him about, you know, his experience? What else did he tell you about what aging means to him?
Something that I thought was really cool, another thing he mentioned about his band was what an experience it is to watch their sort of comfort with one another and being sort of affectionate and loving and sharing beds and hotel rooms when they need to when they're touring without it having sort of any kind of like romantic or sexual undertone, just their comfort and being with each other. And he described just like the how amazing it is to see them move through the world with fewer hangups than he felt like he had to sort of push through, that he was seeing a world that he had kind of imagined to be able to be true, lived out by these younger bandmates. I really liked the way he said that.
Mm. Again, talking with Anna Sale, host of the WNYC podcast, Death, Sex, and Money. Tonight, she is co-hosting a special with Colorado Public Radio called Getting Real About Getting Older. and it's going to air tonight on WLRN starting at 8 p.m. Your co-host is Joanne Allen from Colorado Public Radio, and my understanding, she is over that age, right? She's up at the...
She's a 67-year-old woman, yes.
Yeah, so she's coming in from that perspective of, well, she's in that place, so she's seeing it, you know, from the listeners that you're trying to reach tonight.
Yeah, and that's what was really fun about working on this with her. She works for Colorado Public Radio, and she also hosts her own podcast called Been There, Done That, where she interviews fellow boomers about their being in this time of life together. And what was fun about having her participate is, you know, she's a single woman, she lives by herself, and talking to people who are in much different positions at this point in their lives. Maybe they've been in a 40 to 50 year marriage, you know, and talking about what their social structures and support systems have looked like. It's been nice to hear kind of her talking to her peers when it comes to age group, but then also you can hear the contrast and how, you know, when you get to that age, you know, it's like listening to the stories of your accumulated life choices, and then you can compare how one person ended up compared to where you did.
Yeah. In another recent podcast episode, you heard from a Dr. Norma, and I hope I'm saying this right, Ilya Cantu, my apologies.
Yeah, Cantu. Uh-huh.
Cantu, thank you. She's 74, a writer and a professor. She talked about caring for her mother and father in her old age. Let's take a listen.
Once, when she was very sick, she was in the hospital, and she asked me to forgive her, and I didn't quite know why. So I asked why, and then she said, well, because you were the oldest, you didn't have a childhood. You helped me co-parent all these children. And I had never really put it from that perspective. I had always thought of it as just what I did. And of course, I started crying and I said, of course, I forgive you. There's nothing to forgive. All of this is in Spanish, of course.
Her mother later developed Alzheimer's, and that's one of the challenges of aging, is taking care of your aging parents. What did you learn from Norma?
Oh, I just loved my interview with Norma. Norma is a writer who grew up along the border. She's the oldest of 11 kids. And so hearing that moment where she's talking with her mother about what it was like to, you know, be the oldest, to help her mother raise so many, and then at the end of her mother's life, hearing her mother reflect on, you know, sort of her gratitude for what Norma did to help the family when she was a young woman, and also to be able to see the opportunities that Norma was able to create in her life. She went on to get a PhD. She teaches literature in San Antonio. She's the president of the American Folklore Society. And I loved hearing the ways that the conversations that Norma was able to have with her mother when her mother was at the end of her life, you know, it shaped the way they both thought about aging and the beginnings of their relationship when Norma was a young woman.
Yeah. You know, I wonder too, going back to something you said a moment ago, is that a lot of people were ready for these questions to be asked. And Do you get the sense that people are listening? Are people listening to, because that was always kind of a part of like growing up, like listen to your elders, and you want to talk to them because they have all these stories, but do you get the sense in the folks you've talked to that they feel like anyone's listening to them?
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot more listening that could be done. We had one listener who left a voice memo for us, and it was this wonderful line. She said, you know, there's all these people wondering, you know, what was happening in America in the 1970s and 1980s, you know, 1960s. We were here. Just ask us. So that ended up being the name of one of the episodes that we did, that when you just take the moment to be intentional, to turn to someone who's older in your life, or even if you are older and you've got a friend who's also older, and to say, what are you noticing about aging? You can have some really important conversations.
Mm. And I mean, I'm not going to assume, but I wonder, like with the conversation you're going to have tonight, that COVID's going to pop up a lot. And I'm wondering just how that's affected people, you know, over that age of 60. You know, has it made it harder for them? Obviously, when we look at the numbers, I mean, this is a group most affected by the disease. But I don't know. What do you think? How much do you want to spend talking about that? What do you think is going to come up?
Well, you know, I think that was part of our motivation, was to say, like, how have you been experiencing this time? And for some people, I talked to a man who became a primary caregiver for his grandchildren because his daughter and her husband both worked full time. And he was just overwhelmed and moved to tears to talk about what this year has meant for his relationship with this 3-year-old grandchild. Mm. I talked to another New Yorker who talked about being a jazz musician and just retired when he was 80, and he's now in his late 80s, and he's really appreciated this time at home because he told me he's practicing a lot more. He's practicing his bass a lot more, you know. But I think that for others, it's been a real time of feeling like time has been snatched away from you, and a real frustration about wanting to get back to being able to be closer to family, with family, visit family. And so I do want to hear more about, you know, as we begin to sense and sniff maybe some return to something, as the vaccinations continue, I want to hear what people who are older, how they're thinking about how they want to spend their time and what's important to them, and if that's changed at all through going through this last year.
Well, we'll likely hear it in tonight's conversation again. Anna Sale, host of the WNYC podcast Death, Sex, and Money Tonight, hosting a special with Colorado Public Radio. It's called Getting Real About Getting Older. It airs tonight on WLRN starting at 8 p.m. Anna, thanks so much for sharing. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And again, that starts at 8 o'clock tonight on WLRN. And that's our program for this Wednesday, February 3rd. Coming up tomorrow on the program, illegal fishing remains a critical problem for marine ecosystems across the globe. The State of the World Conference is at FIU this week. We'll take a look at that issue. Plus, a panel conversation about recycling in South Florida. We'll hear from advocates working in the field, and we'll take your calls. All of that coming up tomorrow on the program. Don't forget, by the way, we're reading Swamplandia by Karen Russell. It is the February title for the Sundial Book Club. Find us on Facebook. Just look up Sundial Book Club. We'd love to have you. Tell us what you think of the book as you're reading it. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, stay safe, be good to each other. We'll talk to you live tomorrow.